Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Press One for Democracy. This is Dan Aronson, your host, coming to you as usual from Mighty Bank School Abbott River in Portland, Oregon, where it is a beautiful, beautiful day here. I'm enjoying sunshine that is I was a little chilly today, but not going to complain. Anytime, city's in blue, coming out at the end of the season. Great stuff. However, I'm originally here to talk tonight about something a little bit less fun. We're talking about why it is that we allow ourselves to let politicians and the 1% media divide us and get us at each other's throats whenever we want to talk politics. And really, you know, basically push the anti-Coffee Party message, right? So Coffee Party is about promoting civil, fact-based, transpartisan conversation where we invite everybody to the table, we have nice civil discussions, we look for our common ground, and we find it, and we move forward. But, you know, there's a lot of people that that actually that's not a very good thing for. There's people that don't really care to push civility. They don't care to push fact-based. They push mythical, philosophical hogwash. And again, it's all designed to keep us fighting at each other so that they can then go off to Washington, shut their doors, go behind the closed doors into the dark places in the halls of power in Washington and do their little dirty dealings. And meanwhile, who's watching? Because we're certainly not watching because we're busy fighting each other. So, should be a great show tonight. Had a lot of really good conversation. And as a matter of fact, on the Facebook post earlier today, I had a gentleman who had a lot of great insight. I actually invited him to be my guest host for this evening's show, or at least a special guest on the show. He is going to be joining us later in the show. He had to actually go and pick up his son, you know, all those family duties and whatnot, family first. And but later we hope that he'll be calling in and joining us and giving us his own take on this topic. In the meantime, we are a call-in show. We are a caller-driven show. Without the callers, well, it's just me yapping and my wife keeps reminding me after 28 years that nobody wants me just to hear me yap for hours. So please do call us at 646-929-2495. Again, that's 646-929-2495. And when you get into the queue, you just press 1. That little hand raises on my board, and it tells me you want to join the conversation. We've got a couple of callers in queue, but nobody's raising their hands. That's quite all right. It's early. We also have a bunch of people in the chat. So, of course, chat users are free to type away, and we'll always keep an eye on the chat room. And they're saying I'm breaking up, but now that's better. Okay, good. As long as we're better, that's good, but keep me informed, and if we have to change modes of communication, then we certainly will. And I see we have hands up coming up already. So I tell you what, without further ado, like I said, it's a call-in show. Let's go to the calls. We've got 513, and then we're going to go to what looks like a Skype caller after that. So 513, we're going to open your mic up. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Laura, I'd like to share a story with you, Dan.
Laura Simmons, it is always a pleasure to hear your lovely voice, and it is always a pleasure and a learning experience when you share stories with us. So I would love to hear your story, Laura. Talk, as we say south of the border, as they say south of the border, dígame.
Okay. Well, I'm on Medicaid right now because the arthritis in my hands so bad that I can't work. So part of Medicaid gets, I get free bus rides, but only to my medical appointments. And I got this one, you know, just teddy bear bus driver, and he's like, talks like he's kind of like bitter. And I thought, you know, something not right here. I'm going to drill down, eventually get to what the heart of the problem is. And I was pretty sure what it was going to end up being. Because it seems like every time it ends up being the same story. He's part of the working poor. You know, those people who make enough money that they couldn't qualify for assistance, but not enough money to afford all the medical care they need or something like that.
Okay.
And sure enough, he has some bulging disc in his back, and he hurts. And every time those buses, which have very lousy shocks, go bumpity-bump, his back hurts even more. He doesn't complain. He doesn't whine. But when somebody on Medicaid gets on that bus and rides for free, and they're coming home from the chiropractor, or he's driving them to the chiropractor, a little bit of bitterness and resentment kind of comes in. And he feels like they're getting Santa Claus presents. And here he is working 40 hours a week, and he can't get his pain taken care of. But he's paying taxes to pay for them to get taken care of. And there you go. Is that set up that way on purpose? You gotta wonder.
So, okay. That, as always, you know, you hear these stories and you go, "Oh, that can't possibly be the way." But let me just—I just want to repeat and summarize so I make sure I understand. So you're saying that. So this is a bus driver who works for the local county transportation, I assume.
Correct.
Okay, and he is not paid a living wage.
No, they make somewhere between $10 and $12 an hour, depending on how long they've been doing it.
Okay. It seems to me that, I mean, in most cases, but then again, with sequestration and all kinds of problems people are having with their retirement funds, right, with their pensions in the public sector, I guess maybe that the benefits are waning and pay is waning. That's I don't know that I feel how I feel about somebody with an axe to grind driving around, you know, people every day. That sounds almost a little scary, but
Dan. No, this guy is a big loving teddy bear. I got those vibes from him right away. It's the pain talking, hon. He demands his pain driving on those with those bumps.
Laura,
honey, if you had a bulging disc,
I'm blaming the people that are making him work for such low wages. That's crazy.
Well, you know, everybody's medical insurance, the premiums have gone up, the co-pays have gone up, the deductibles have gone up. That's happened to everybody. I don't care who you're employed by. It's happened to everybody.
Well,
what they cover has gone down.
Okay.
And, you know, I just got the news today of what the deal is with my disability pay, and my spend down is about half of my income. I have to spend about $500 a month on my medical expenses before Medicaid will kick in. So people think we get a totally free ride and all this other stuff. Not really.
Well, I know you told me that it's a ridiculously low threshold where you actually even have to qualify. You know, you said it's like $500 or $600 a month, and if you make more than that, then your benefits go down. So,
including my food stamps, I'm allowed to live off of $658. But then I'm allowed to live with my boyfriend for free. So that's not too bad.
Okay. Well, I don't know your boyfriend, but I'm going to take you at your word.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. Is there any way you can relate this back to the show's topic tonight of how politicians and the 1% media are keeping at each other's throats?
Yeah, well, of course. Like I said, the way the system is set up, people are resenting because they're in that position where they're just a little over. And this is also why people have such a hard time getting off the system. Dan, I had a fight with a girl I took a class with. Meijer, which is a food, which is a grocery store, but kind of a mega store because they also have some clothing and other types of items like Walmart's do, like a Walmart superstore does.
Sure.
She said that if she had someone come in, now you got to realize we're talking about a minimum wage, low class job. If they did not come in professionally dressed, she would not consider them as a viable candidate for a minimum wage, low job.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's been something I've been talking about ever since, you know, the so-called recovery happened and people said, look, we lost 4.4 million jobs or 4.3 million jobs, but we gained back 4.4 million jobs. So look, the economy's coming back. But then when you tear it down and you break it down, you see that what happened is, of the jobs that were recovered, 1.6 million people went from mid-wage jobs to low-wage jobs. So now we have this other epidemic of underemployment. So your employment numbers or unemployment numbers don't look so bad, but what you've got is you've got people that were making $40,000, $50,000 a year that are taking, you know, jobs at $20,000 a year and just trying to put food on their tables and keep roofs over their families' homes. And it's, you know, that's why I've called this, you know, it's kind of the faux recovery for me. And it's
nicely to make wages that low, I'm like, I'm in shock. I'm in total shock. I hear I'm making $7-8 an hour and you expect me to look like a million.
Yeah. So I think you're actually hitting on a different angle of the way that government is helping to, or that the government suppresses us and keeps us angry as a whole. And that is that you're right. I mean, we don't have a working, or I should say, we don't have a minimum wage at which point people can make a, you know, have a decent living or have any living at all. And I think that's one of the things I put out on my post is the promoting the show. Let's see, what was that one? And again, you got a vast majority, 71% support raising the minimum wage to at least $9 an hour. And there was another poll that quoted 66% raising it, were cool raising it to $10 an hour. So that is one of the many areas that most Americans, the majority of Americans, and let's face it, in this country, 70%, that's a huge majority. You know, when you have most things, most elections are 1% and 2% races, right? So 70% is a huge majority of Americans say raise the minimum wage. So where is the vote? Where is the bill coming to the floor in the House of Representatives or a bill coming on the Senate floor to raise the minimum wage? Where is it?
I think there was one, Dan, and I heard it got voted down, but that may have been, you know how rumors can fly around the internet and be a lie.
I didn't know
where to verify it. So somebody said there was a place to verify it, and I believe it was Eric Beiler. And I said,
I always go to PolitiFact. Yeah, PolitiFact is where I always go. But and maybe one of our other callers will know tonight, and we can ask him, or somebody can look it up on the internet. My guess is that it probably never got out of committee and never got to the floor for a vote.
I could believe that.
It probably was just killed. So, but again, I mean, that's it. So, absolutely. Well, Laura, always good to hear from you. I've got a couple other callers in queue. As always, press 1, your hand will go down. Press 1, we'll get you right back on. Does it sound good?
Okay. Good.
All right. Keep positive. It's so great to hear you. That is Laura Simmons, one of our regular contributors, calling in from Cincinnati. Now I'm going to do something very dangerous that I always have a little, I always have trepidation doing. I'm going to a Skype caller because they come through on our board as 1111, and last week we had the Banana Man, and well, that turned out to be a little bit of a not funny diversion. So anyway, I'm hoping that this Skype caller is wanting to talk about serious stuff and the topic at hand. Skype caller, your mic is open. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
My name is Paul. I'm not Banana Man. I'm using Skype because it allows me the convenience of using a headset.
Beautiful. Me too. That's exactly why I'm using it too, Paul. We have several callers come in and they're just looking to mess with people, and so I'm glad you're not. Paul, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Georgia.
You're calling from, okay, another Georgia caller. I still own my home in Marietta, Georgia, which I think now finally not upside down in.
Oh, awesome. Congratulations.
So if you're in the hood, welcome to the show. What say you, Paul?
Well, I want to let you know that we are neighbors. I am actually in Ackworth.
Okay,
and,
great.
I am very serious about politics, and the woman that was just on, I think her name was Laura. I definitely feel her pain on this. Personally, I think that the elderly and handicapped and people that have advanced medical needs, they are just not taken care of the way they should be. And I have a special affinity for the veterans that don't get treated the way they should be. And you touched on a bunch of things that I'm very heavily opinionated with this stuff. I have been on Egberto's show, and me and him don't see eye to eye. He is far left. I am kind of like pretty far right, a little to the middle, but not much. Frankly, the division really annoys me, and I put postings on, I make comments on the Coffee Party trying to encourage people to think outside the parties and to think not like, and this is going to sound a little insulting, but it's meant for the attitude of the people. Don't think like a Republican or a Democrat. Think like an American, and that's not meant to disrespect anybody. That's just the attitude that people convey toward the other side. You know, we have a duopoly in the government. It's been raging on and on for many years. They're both heavily funded by, you know, by private, I forgot the word I was thinking of, like special interest groups and so on.
Yep.
Until we get them out, we are going to keep falling deeper and deeper into trouble. You know, this guy that I knew had a saying, and it rings so true. He says that I'm not sure if I can say this word, but you'll let me know if I cannot. he says the Democrats screw you, and the Republicans use lube.
Hang on here, because I got a bunch of comments to make. First of all, Paul, I want to thank you for being someone who has refused to play the game. You are obviously a man who has no problem espousing an opinion, having an intellectually honest and open conversation, respecting the views. I know if you've been on with Egberto, then you've got the right stuff, and this you're doing it the right way. And I want to thank you for doing that, and thank you for being involved, and thank you for being somebody who can come at a political opposite with something that is fact based and civil. And man, and look, in 1 second, you actually found common ground with Egberto and people like me. You say you're far right, but then you're talking about taking care of the elderly, taking care of the sick, and taking care of our veterans. And those things are typically, if you were going to plot those positions out, most people, I think, would think of those as more left-wing positions. But here you found common ground, and here we have a basis for moving forward. And it only happens because you are willing to have this conversation the way you're willing to have it and not start throwing around, you know, names like libtard or teabagger or the kinds of things that just kill communications between the two sides, right? So just wanted to give you a big props and thank you for engaging like that.
I do want to say something, though, that, yes, I, you know, everything that you said is true, but the big difference is that I don't agree with the way liberals want to do it. I have a very different idea on how things should be. And, you know, I laugh at the people that say teabaggers, because I'm sitting there thinking, you know what, you want to say teabagger? You want to know what they think of you?
Well, you wanna, yeah, exactly. You know, again, don't. I don't want to cut you off here, but I want to bring it back. So I want to hear your idea of how we can take care of the elderly and the sick and the handicapped and the disabled and the veterans. I want to hear because you say you have a different idea. What's your angle? Bring. You know, give us your pitch. How if you were king for the day, how would you solve that problem?
My idea requires a complete overhaul of the government, getting rid of anything that is unnecessary, cut foreign aid, cut tons of things. I say tons of things because really I have to use a blanket statement because there's just so much to cut. I would institute the Fair Tax Act, and some people say, well, that's not enough. Well, you know what? If you were to cut all of government that's not necessary, then you don't really need a whole lot of tax, at least not as much tax as that's being paid now. So if you cut all that stuff, yes, I'm simplifying, which Egberto doesn't agree with me on, then you have less money needs to be dished out, you have a ton of money coming in, and I would get rid of Obamacare, frankly. It was, to me, it was the biggest mistake in the world. And I would give Social Security a bit more, I would give it more funding, put it where it needs to be. Don't give it to those that frankly aren't entitled to it.
Aren't entitled to it from the fact they didn't put in? Or are you saying that, like, institute means testing so that people that are rich that don't really need it don't get it?
Rich people don't need it. The Social Security was meant for those that need it. Okay? The rich, you know, don't need it. You know,
So you're in favor of means testing for Social Security?
What's that?
So you're in favor of means testing for Social Security, and why well, as why not stop there? Why stop there? Why not do it for Medicare and Medicaid? And I'm not saying that is there's no judgment there. I'm just saying, bing, there's now somewhere where you now have common ground with folks on the left. There's a lot of people on the left that think the same thing. I think this is a beautiful example. First of all, I think this is where the failing. This is a big failure of the bipolar matrix or bipolar, I said linear definition that everybody uses, left and right. Because I think that if you put up enough issues and say, what do you feel, and you take a survey on all these different issues, I think you'll plot up all over the part. That's why I'm a big fan of the transpartisan matrix, because I think that gives us two dimensions to work with, four quadrants. I think it's a lot more accurate. But I'm hearing a lot of things where I know people like Egberto and other people that would consider themselves more left that absolutely would agree with you. And this is the beauty. And if you represented every conservative in the world and we could get people just like you on the left, we fix this thing in a hurry. And we might not agree on how to do it, but here's the thing. You're willing to work, probably, I'm guessing, you're willing to work towards some compromise where maybe it's some from column A and some from column B, and we get there. Am I right in that assumption?
Well, kind of like yes and no. I had a funny thing. Igberto asked me a very similar question, but worded in a way that he has a way with wording. Me and him heavily disagree on very key issues. One of the things that me and him disagree on is redistribution. I am not a redistributionist. I believe that if you earn this money, do what you want with it. He says to me one time, it was a while ago, how is it fair that this one person has a ton of money and is playing in the stock market and whatnot, and so the person is struggling to pay their bills? You know what? I'm struggling to pay my bills. I'm not expecting any handouts. You know, my father and my stepfather had it rough. Even, you know, like my father-in-law, they had rough lives. They made their lives themselves. They did not get handouts. You know, it's not needed. And people like to bring up, I happen to be a Christian, and people like to talk about, you know, the liberals like to bring up Jesus and say, well, you know, he was a redistribution. Now, he was about voluntary redistribution. He never ever forced anything on anyone. You know, I have no problem with helping out my fellow man. If a friend of mine needs something, I'm there for him. What I have a problem with is when the government takes my money to give it to somebody else.
Okay, I hear you, Paul. Listen, we've got a couple other callers in queue, and I definitely want to thank you for, again, coming on and putting out your views there in a civil manner, having an intelligent, honest discussion with me. And I'd like you to hold on, if you don't mind. I want to mute you, but I want you to hold on because, maybe we can get some good transpartisan conversation going, maybe a little left v. right. And maybe we'll just disprove this whole thing about everybody fighting all the time, because apparently, well, I don't know, I guess that's the coffee party's way. So I guess everybody so far checking in the coffee party way. And speaking of which, I'm going to open up 404. Is this Mr. Roberts?
I thought you weren't going to guess anymore.
yeah, but you know what? I'm getting your number straight. I get the 8047. I'm like, yeah, I think that's him. So
you're trying to get some rhythm there, huh? I understand.
Yeah,
good evening.
All good, man. What's going on?
Well, you know, life itself. It's crazy out here. I don't know what it's like. I don't know what it's like in Blog Talk Radio Land, but it's pretty crazy out here in the world, I have to tell you. The gentleman that was just speaking, I actually remember him in other conversations, probably all from Egberto's show, actually, because I know it was definitely at least once or twice there. So glad to hear your comments, of course, always. I offer a couple of observations. One of the things that disturbs me in the polarization conversation is negative conversation about the Affordable Care Act, and not because I'm some great supporter of the act or not, but what always concerns me, and you hear me say this all the time, is I prefer to take my own observations and facts and not have anybody form the discussion for me. Now, and what I mean by that, bringing this particular instance up, is everything that I have seen about the act thus far from states that have actually implemented it or insurance companies that have actually created the model already has been positive. And that doesn't mean it's going to stay that way, but that's what's coming out of California, that's what's coming out of Connecticut, and that's what's coming out of a couple of the big insurance carriers, including one in Florida. Now, there is plenty of negative. We've heard it from day one, of course. And we've heard a lot of comments about what the act does, what the act doesn't do. My problem with the negativity about the act is that there is no evidence that has been offered in that I've ever seen, credible evidence other than conjecture, because the act hasn't been implemented yet. The majority of the act hasn't started yet, except by two states that have implemented the process. And by insurance companies that have created the model. They've been actually doing it for over a year. So unless, and most people haven't done this, unless you read the act and you find something specific there, or I found, it's one of the gaps that I found in the election process last year. with all the polarization that went on in the election process, no one offered to me a credible evidence about the Affordable Health Care Act. And they were doing it so much that I decided to read the thing myself to see what was in there because I wasn't getting any decent conversation about it. So I say that. And then I think that government is too big. I think that government needs to be more responsible. And I think that waste needs to be cut out. And I think that in and of itself would create government being smaller. And then
there you go. You and Paul just found common ground. You don't agree on the Affordable Health Care Act, but you sure just found common ground on. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how when people talk about taxation, that's what they talk about. It's always a one-sided conversation with people. If you go to the store. Let's say you've had a good year and you're gonna buy yourself a little present. You're gonna buy yourself a new cell phone or whatever. You go to the store. You've got 8,000 different choices. You got all kinds of different costs and feature sets and whatnot. So you compare and you contrast and you look at what am I getting for how much money I'm spending. It's called value. No one ever speaks about value when they talk about our tax dollars and what we get in return for services. I mean, if they do, I never hear it. Everybody always wants to say it's a one-sided conversation. We need to cut wasteful spending. Absolutely, we do. We need to increase taxes so that we can pay down the debt and fix our ailing infrastructure. Absolutely, we do. Both wonderfully legitimate arguments, but separately, they mean nothing. Just to say I'm going to cut out wasteful spending doesn't mean anything, you know, because I'll tell you why. I happen to be in software sales, and I deal a lot with government contracts. And here's what I know about government contracts and government budgets. It come the end of the fiscal year, which I believe is June 30th, if a department has a budget and they haven't spent it, they're looking to spend that money. Why? Because if they don't spend it, the next year their budget will get slashed. You know, responsible government spending, I frankly don't believe it exists. Not at all. So you know, we have to have a more intelligent conversation, and it's got to be about value. Because can we not pay taxes? Yeah, we could end up in jail like Al Capone did. But can we demand value for our money? Yeah, absolutely. But it's the combination of what you are talking about and what Paul is talking about that gets us there. And gosh darn this all you people for calling in here and being civil and fact-based and wonderful, because this show was about how people are too busy being at each other's throats to have these conversations. If we could only just reproduce this and push this out.
Well, I think that part of it has to be, Dan, that we have to break up the monopoly of the two-party system. The event that I'm involved with, as you know, the United We Stand Fest, I believe that the main purpose of it, regardless of all the different issues that are going to be discussed there, and the fact that Jesse's going to be speaking and Gary Johnson's going to be speaking and Jill Stein's going to be speaking, but the real point is that there has to be access to more choices. We don't need a third party. We need like 10. I mean, we need to open up this discussion, and we need to remove the monopoly because they're playing a game in Washington, a very serious game. And to me, this recent stuff with the NSA, it just goes to show it. You know, everybody's already heard since this has happened. I have been saying I love the fact that everybody's mad at something that we've been doing for so many years, and everybody in the name of patriotism was on board for this when it was done, and now here's what we have, and the vote was 98-1 in the Senate, for example. You know, and everybody thought that Russ Feingold was some, you know, out of whack liberal guy who didn't know what he was talking about. Meanwhile, he was the only person in the Senate that actually did, or at least would say it out loud and didn't care about the fact of whether or not he was going to get reelected or not. You know,
yeah.
So we need to have and then just to add on to that, when they reauthorized the act in 2011, the vote in the Senate, I don't even want to care about the House, the vote in the Senate was 86-12. So you had two GOP, you had nine Democrats, and Bernie Sanders. That was the people who voted against it. Now, who would ever think that Rand Paul and Mike Lee and Bernie Sanders could be in the room together? You talk about having common ground. How about that for common ground? Because
it
you're
can
talking
happen.
About two complete opposite ends of the political spectrum right there. But
well, there
when
you
it's
go.
Right, it's right. Absolutely. So it's a perfect example of what you're talking about as far as finding common ground. We have
proof
to
positive. You know what? Let me do something really quick here. I'm gonna open your mic up again, Paul, and tell me how you feel about the somewhat draconian regulations and rules that have been slowly put into place, starting with the Patriot Act in 2001 and continuing through FISA and NDA 2012 and 2013. What are your feelings on that?
Well, I have to kind of laugh at saying the word somewhat. but tell you, I like this show more than Roberto's. I like what you have to say, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch the gentleman's name.
That's Robert.
Hi, Robert.
It's Robert Rodrigo.
Hey,
I'm sure you've chatted
Rodrigo.
With on the Roberto's show.
I know you.
Yeah.
You're Roberto's good friend.
Oh,
you
okay.
It's all Rodrigo.
We'll go with that.
You guys are neighbors.
Sort of.
Guys,
yeah.
Robert, you I forget you don't live in Marietta.
I live in Ackworth.
You guys.
Yeah, I remember Paul. I always remember the guys that are local.
Oh man,
like,
where in Ackworth
like
are you?
Each other at the grocery store. I'm right by
Lake Allatoona.
Lake Allatoona? Oh, I just drove by there today. Wow. Okay. Wow, that's crazy. I wanted to mention something. Sorry, I forgot. Dan, I wanted to mention that you said that we need taxes to take care of the debt. My only issue with that is I equate that to taking care of a child. I have a 10-year-old. He asks me for money. Before I give him the money, I pay attention to how he's spending it. If I don't like how he's spending it, I'm not going to give him money. As a matter of fact, I tell him, well, he has this thing where he takes out trash for money. So, you know, you want to wastefully spend? Waste your own money. I'm not inclined to want to give the government anything until they can get their current stuff under control. You know, you said put value in it. Absolutely put value in it. Right now, there's very little value in what they're doing. And, you know, when it came to, I remember it was Mr. Rodrigo. I'm sorry. When it comes to the whole NSA deal with the, you know, it has been going on for a long time. And somebody mentioned on the Coffee Party page saying that the conspiracy theorists are right. What is the nonsense we've been right about? I'm thinking, yeah, no kidding, right? People have been saying this for a long time, and nobody wants to believe anything. And finally, some things are coming to the surface, like, whoa, what's going on here? The same thing that we've been trying to tell you about for 10 years.
Let me ask you a question, Paul, please, if you don't mind.
Sure. No,
this is directly at that particular thing. When the Patriot Act was introduced by Congress and by George Bush, did you support the idea of it?
I supported the concept, but I did not support the act.
So when if I understand you correctly, you supported the security idea, but you didn't support the language or what was done inside the act. Is that correct?
Basically, yes. I understood that he wanted to do something to protect the nation. It's kind of like the Affordable Care Act. I understand what you're trying to do. I just don't like the way you're trying to do it.
Hmm. So the reason I ask it that way is because when you mentioned the conspiracy theorists, in this particular instance, I would actually equate other events, recent events, that might possibly work better to that than I do the NSA thing. And the reason I say it that way is because
one of the things that was going on since the attack of my home city and in our country, one of the things that happened is that any time that you dissented in with the Patriot Act or against the war of Iraq, which was one of the biggest shams we've ever seen in my life,
yeah,
is you were unpatriotic to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking both sides of the aisle here, or whatever the hell that aisle is, or where they are down there. We're not. This is a nonpartisan thing, and it's coming out during this, scandal that, all of the sides are saying this is the way it's supposed to be, and this is fine, and all three branches of the government support it, and that is absolutely true. Now, I don't agree with it. I have never agreed with the Patriot Act. I have been one of these. I've screamed as loud as Russ Feingold was. And I'll bet you don't like Russ Feingold just by the nature of your conservative politics. Not to say that that's wrong or anything like that. I'm just saying he's probably not somebody that you listen or aspire to, some of his stuff that I'm sure you don't like. But this is an example, as I mentioned earlier, what Dan was talking about having things in common. He is was the only person in the Senate that was screaming about this. It was amazing to watch. And of course, the ACLU was, and other constitutional organizations were. And one of the things that I noticed back then that was frustrating to me was if I looked at it from a partisan standpoint, the way I perceived it was that the conservatives were all for it big time, and the liberals were afraid not to get reelected. So they kind of mm-hmm. went along with it as well, some of them. And it drove me crazy. Now, I think I've evolved past that thinking, because really they both sides want it. I mean, Dianne Feinstein's comments, along with our wonderful Saxby, have been amazing to listen to. But, it is the law. And we sat there and let them do it. And then in 2006, the USA Today came out with an article that discussed everything that we've just seen in this past week about this particular issue at length. And it blew it up again, and all the people that was talking about it when it first came out, blown up, and nothing happened. No, and I think that a part of this is that the Kool-Aid is different that we're drinking, because we have a man in Washington, right, wrong, or indifferent, that has polarized this country even more so, just on the basis, even if you don't bring the race factor into it, it's on the basis of the culture that has been going around it. It should have been screamed about as much when George was in office as it is now, because it is exactly the same thing that's happened. And then we talk about this gentleman who leaked the information. And I said this the other day on Eric Berto's show, is he's not a whistleblower, because the whistleblower is when you catch a company or a government doing something illegal. This is not illegal. He broke the law, and if it wasn't about the issues that we're talking about, we would all want his head, because he would be somebody who was leaking classified information. So all these things are going mm-hmm. on. It's like a ten-sided argument here, or not argument, ten-sided issue. It is amazing to me the way this is, and I find it interesting talking to people who supported the Patriot Act, to see where they are now, and I believe part of it is that it is this particular president that is bringing it out as well.
Well, wait, hold on. Let me get a word in here, Edgewise, on my show. So point of fact, right? We had the Patriot Act originally passed right back in 2001, but there was a reaffirmation of the Patriot Act in 2006. So now 5 years after this has all gone down, long time since 9/11, but now we're embroiled in Iraq and the whole shooting match there. So as you said, it was 98-1 in the Senate. In the 2006 reaffirmation of the Patriot Act, or the re-upping, if you will, what do you think the vote was,
I don't know the vote, but I know what it was in 2011, as I mentioned. It was
89-9.
Sure.
It was 89-9, and in the House it was a little bit more split. 145 Democrats joined with 211 Republicans and one independent in reaffirming it, 357-66. So here we were,
go.
5 years later, none the wiser. So now here we are 7 years after that, and
wait, Dan,
increased.
It happened,
we've had more of this.
It happened again in 2011.
Can I
respond? Three parts of the Patriot Act were just reaffirmed in 2011.
Well, right. Five was ripped out and was his own thing, and then, yeah. Oh, I agree. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
So now,
yeah,
finally.
We're not wiser. No.
It's sad, and so I'm going to get Joel's thoughts here, too. Paul? Paul, I'm sorry, Paul.
It's okay. you open up a can of worms. But, you know, a lot of what you mentioned comes down to a lot of the polarization. You know, I was, when 9/11 happened, before I really took a close look at that, I was like, get them. And then after a while, I got to thinking that, you know, there was a lot of conspiracy around this. Like, were there WMDs? Was it about oil? Was it about daddy? You know, what was it about? And then after a while, I came to realize that we went into this not realizing what we're getting into. We were not going to fight up against a nation. We're going to fight up against a religion, frankly. You know, despite what anybody wants to say, these people are extremists. They're fundamentalists, and the war is raging on partly because they fight for a different reason than we fight. It's not their, it's our job, so to speak, but it is their life. And, you know, as time went on, so of course you have the Republicans backing Bush, you have the Democrats attacking, kind of doing it in a little bit of a timid sense because of the fact that, you know, Bush has, you know, everything going on for him. You know, you bring in the Patriot Act, which, if I'm researching correctly, had a lot of pork in it, which is also kind of something that I'm not particularly liking about the Affordable Care Act. And then you have coming in, you know, he got elected in his second term, largely because it's not a good idea to, you know, to have a different president in a time of war. So then you have, once that comes around, you know, 4 years later, you have, next thing you know, McCain and Obama. I'm sitting there looking at the election, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, you know, I think it's great that we have a black candidate, but I do not like what's coming out of his mouth. But McCain cannot keep it cool. I know who's going to win this, and of course, you know, Obama won, and next thing you know, he's got all the black votes, a lot of minority votes, because unfortunately, it was not about who's the best candidate. It was about, hey, we got a black guy. Now, granted, I am not racist at all whatsoever. I think it's awesome we have a black president. I think it's unfortunate that, in my opinion, he sucks.
All right, hold the phone. So we can find a better way of saying that.
I'm sorry, replace sucks with miserable failure.
So let's not totally drive off the road here and make this into a huge political debate about everything. You know, let's try to steer back on the road here for a second. So the two of you agree that the Patriot Act and all the things that have followed, not good, right?
Correct.
I mean, personally, I'm with you.
I think the Patriot Act is a due process violation, and it undermines the Fourth Amendment in a due process way that the document doesn't intend it, and upon the basis of legitimate government interest, which is the excuse they always use.
Right. And the NDAA, the Gitmo whole thing with Gitmo, and you can now be put in prison, and that, you know, that's a violation of habeas corpus and due process, and yeah, it's serious. But see, again, here you guys agree. Now the question is, what's the answer? I'll tell you my answer, and then I'll let you guys have your answer so I can go quiet my dog down. My answer is repeal it all. Because, frankly, and I came up with this, and Janine, I know you're out there listening. Here's my bumper sticker. Ready? I'd rather live in fear of my enemies than live in fear of my government. Robert, go.
Well, we definitely should repeal it. I don't know if that's practical. I certainly want it. There's no question about it. The problem with it from a practical standpoint is that our Supreme Court has signed off on it on the same argument that I mentioned earlier, legitimate government interest. I think the solving of a lot of problems in this country would be, and it might sound off issue, but I don't think it is. I think that the problem is number one, we need to eliminate corporate personhood because that has a lot to do with our problems, especially when it comes to our media truth. And then I believe that we need to stop calling what's going on with terrorism a war, because we war for profit, regardless of why anybody else does it. We should not have been in Afghanistan for 10 years. We should not have taken that long to Iraq. If we go to war, really war, to beat the crap out of somebody because we're defending our country, it should have took us no more than 2 years to destroy Afghanistan. I know too much about
okay,
how
but
our
I'm
war
gonna,
machine
I'm,
works.
Robert, I'm gonna get McLaughlin on you. All right,
Robert Rodrigo, repeal the Patriot Act or let it stand.
I'll repeal it.
Okay. Paul, repeal the Patriot Act or let it stand.
Repeal it.
Boom. And there we have it, folks. Common ground.
Why can't a murderer do that?
Because I'll tell I love Egberto to death, and everybody has their own way, and everybody has their. I hate to say it, right, because we know who said it, right? I'm a uniter, not a divider. All right, hang with me, guys, for a second. I got to do the pause for the cause. I love it. I hope you guys are loving this as much as I'm loving this. This is a fun conversation. We're not on topic because, gosh darn it, we're all being coffee party-esque and we're all following the rules and we're all being nice to each other. So it looks like the coffee party is doing a lot of good. And so I just want to give, again, the pause for the cause, which means we are a totally member-driven funded organization. Every penny we get comes from you, the membership, or you not being members yet, but yet joining today. I won't say any names, but I'm very proud to say a friend of mine joined today as a sustaining member, and that's one of the two ways you can join. So if you go to www.coffeepartyusa.com, you can click on the button to become a member, and there's two ways you can join. You can either do a one-time annual fee of $30, or you can do more than that, of course. Or you can become a sustaining member, which means that every month you can put in 5, 10, 15, 20, or as Janine always likes to say, you know what, $10,000, that's fine. We won't mind. But just don't ask us for any favors because money does not buy you power in the coffee party. So it's a beautiful thing, and we're here to promote civil, transpartisan, fact-based conversation. We want everybody to come to the table, and I think we just saw the most beautiful example here with Paul and Robert, coming from different ends of the spectrum on a bunch of different issues, and then bam, we found exact common ground, and Janine threw her vote in there via the board to repeal, so we've got consensus. Now let's go to Washington, now let's make sure in 2014 the people we send to Washington promise to repeal that act. We have a brand new caller in queue. I'm going to go to you, 301. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi, it's Brian.
Hi, Brian. How are you, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Maryland.
Maryland. Brian. It's our special guest star. How
That's
you doing,
me.
Brian? Okay.
I'm doing better.
You're doing that. Your son okay? All good? You got it picked up?
My son is fine. Family crisis averted.
Beautiful, beautiful. So everybody, just so you know, this is Brian Roberts. Brian and I had a back and forth today on and actually one of Janine's Facebook postings, and I was so impressed that I invited him to be on and be the special guest, and he had a little family obligation that kept him from us, but here he is. So, Brian, if you don't mind me reading a little bit of your bio off your Facebook page, would that be okay?
Go right ahead.
All right. So, Brian studied marketing at Columbia University.
He also studied, and I've got to tell you about the, I got to ask you about the University of Chicago experience as well.
Okay.
And now is currently working for the Montgomery County government, which I assume is Montgomery, Maryland. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And what do you do for them?
We run a customer service operation for the government, so we're kind of the front door. It's a 311 service. A lot of cities and counties around the country have them. So you want to get county services and information, you call us first. So instead of dialing 411, yeah, that's what we do.
Are you well funded?
We as well funded as the public sector is funded these days. Let's put it that way.
We were hearing earlier from one of our earlier callers that about a county bus driver that was not well funded, that was being paid low wages and didn't get the medical benefits he was needing. And,
right.
And so it's good to know, you know, and this is one of the things about transpartisanship that they talk about in the book Transpartisan. I'm going to space out on the title of the book, but they talk about the fact that once you get to the local level, that you are much more likely to have transpartisanship be successful because now you're dealing with your neighbors.
Right.
And it's thing to say to, you know, to call into a show and talk to a guy in Atlanta and say, I don't believe what you're saying and I don't really care about you. But it's another thing to look your neighbor in the face and say that same thing. And
right.
And because the common infrastructure is there, you're all sharing in that common infrastructure, right? I mean, your neighbor could be your political opposite, but if they have a kid the same age as your kid and they go to the same schools, I bet you both want that school to be the best school it can be.
It makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. So we've been talking a lot about, the show's topic, actually. We haven't been talking about it because people have been really nice here, but I don't know if you want to weigh in on the idea of the politicians and the 1% media keeping us at each other's throats and keeping us from doing exactly what we're talking about, finding that common ground and finding those
right.
those common solutions we all want. Any thoughts on that?
A ton. You don't have time for all of them, but I will say this: that divide and conquer is not a new strategy. We just have a lot more communication tools and a lot more clever ways to do it. I didn't count it today because it would depress me, but just thinking of the number of email appeals I still get, no matter how many I unsubscribe from issue after issue, that I'm actually, frankly, very interested in. But spending all this time focusing on, individual positions, individual petitions on a particular issue, even from friends, is a distraction from the real issue. It's not just the media playing this game. It's being played on a variety of levels, and so you've really got to be vigilant because it's very easy to get distracted and to think that subscribing to all these petitions is actually activism when it ultimately isn't. It's keeping us distracted and separated. I would like to see the groups understand that while we need experts who understand different issues, we need coalitions pull together to make sure that the right things get done. You were talking about what happens at the local level, and what I see here in Montgomery County is interesting because it's a relatively wealthy county, and in many parts of the country, big city suburbs are very Republican, and we're not. I wouldn't call us progressive necessarily, but there's a certain understanding that you've got to pay taxes to make sure the schools are good, so to make sure you've got effective police protection, that there's an infrastructure in place, that there's public transportation. There's not enough of it, but at least there's a recognition that we need it. And we need more of that. But apparently it needs we need more enlightened people to think this way and act this way. and there's not enough of us doing it yet.
So, just curious, besides the coffee party, are you involved in other groups?
I'm involved in local groups where I have to go to actual physical meetings. I participate in certain forums online, but mostly I'm looking around to find, you know, where people are taking, you know, specific action. And so that's where I'm spending more time, is out actually, you know, meeting with people and trying to, forge larger coalitions.
And if you don't mind me asking, what are the issues that these groups are concerned with, and what are their stances on?
Well, my particular area of emphasis is equity in education. There are a lot of reasons for it. I just think it's the right thing to do, number one, but I also think that education is a great way to separate people. And we do it systematically. I mean, obviously, kids in private schools almost always have an advantage over kids in public schools, but we do a very subtle job of segregating kids in public schools and reserve the best education, the best public education for certain kids. And it's in most school districts, it's a very small percentage of the kids. And
are you speaking like about charter schools now?
I'm speaking about regular public schools.
Is it just a matter of funding that because most of the funding comes from the local neighborhoods, that the better funded schools are the ones that have better educations? Or
that's clearly a big part of it. You're going to get a better education in Bethesda, Maryland, than you're going to get in East St. Louis, Illinois, but just because of the tax base of each case. So that's absolutely true. But even in the well-funded schools, and I would say the schools here in Montgomery County are very well-funded, the segregation happens when we start to develop magnet programs and gifted and talented programs, and we have programs that you have to test into, and it starts to separate the kids, and it's almost never based on talent or intellect. It's almost always based on the income and education level of the parents. And that's exactly the opposite of what the public education system is supposed to do. It's supposed to level the playing field, not tilt the balance against the underprivileged, and that's exactly what it does. And that has nothing to do with the funding. That's a deliberate choice.
Okay, so let me put you on the spot a little, like I do to all my guests.
Sure.
And that is this. Okay, Brian, you're king for a day. How do we fix it?
Look out. I'm sorry, Dan?
Yes?
No, go ahead. I just said, you said I would be king for a day, and I said, look out.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, so we're making you king for a day because you have this issue that's bothering you, and we are going to let you fix it. You're now king for a day. How do we fix it?
Well, ultimately what you need to do is give the what is considered to be the gifted program to everybody. You know, that's the simplest thing. Commit to stop segregating kids. Stop saying that this group, these are the smart kids and these are the dumb kids. And they're all smart kids, and treat them that way. Maximize the talent that you have in each individual child. Take them as far as they can go. You know, you have these ridiculous structures that all the 8-year-olds have to be in class together, and then when they turn 9, they all have to go to the next grade. Why don't you say, look, this is what you need to learn in order to be a productive citizen. And if you learn it by the time you're 18, that's great. If you learn it by the time you're 16, that's great. If you learn it, if you don't learn it till you're 20, that's fine too. But that's not the way that
That's really interesting. I actually got a glimpse of that. I had my son in back when I lived in Chicago. I had my son in a Montessori school, although he was just in the preschool. He was just like he was 2 years old. And yeah, that's the Montessori style. Here's the curriculum. Here's the information you have to absorb, and then you have to be able to show me that you've absorbed it, and you can spit it back out and utilize it. And then once you do, you can go on. And so everybody goes at their own pace. Is that feasible to do on a mass scale throughout our public education system?
I don't see why not. I mean, right now, what we do is that we decide that some percentage, let's say it's 20%, are the kids we're really going to invest in, but we tell all the other kids that they have to march through the same number of years, what are we giving those kids? And you look at the graduation rates. And yet we're keeping these kids in school all this time. There's a heck of a lot of waste going on. Why are we doing that? Why would we pay to keep those kids, right? And then at the bad end, the kids who we really mistreat, who end up dropping out, end up in the criminal justice system where we pay three times as much to keep them in jail than it would have cost them to freaking educate them. So that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a very good a friend of my parents who started a program. Actually, it's my sister's husband's mother. And she started a program in an underprivileged neighborhood in Florida. And she said, for $6,000, I can not only keep these kids in schools, but they will excel in school. And she used the money in various programs and for various supplemental things. And she had like a 98% success rate in her program. So how much of it is about pushing the funding and making it locally or locally controlled, or do we need something more uniform? And before you answer that question, I'm going to try to do something. I've never done this before. I've never had the opportunity to do it before, so I'm going to take advantage. I'm going to do this Egberto style. I'm going to open up everybody's microphone. So there goes Robert. Here comes Laura, and here comes Paul. And all I would do is I'm going to leave your mics open and wait. Oop, we've got a new caller. Hold on. We've got a new caller I'm going to bring in here for 1 second. 954, I'm opening your microphone. Who are we speaking with?
Neil. How you doing?
Neil from Fort Lauderdale. How you been, man? It's been a long time.
Good. How are you?
Hey.
Good, good. So Neil, we're just engaging. I don't know if you've been listening along, but we're with our special guest. Brian Roberts, he's on from Maryland. He's involved in a lot of different programs, including and education is his big one. And we're talking about how do we give everybody equal opportunity for education, but also let people go at their own pace. So I've opened up everybody's mics. Is that a topic you're cool talking about?
Sure.
Or did you have something else, please?
Well, I mean, I was going to call in at 9 o'clock and I forgot. I was reading about just in general. I just wish that our senators and everyone in the House would just follow what we actually want instead of what the corporations need.
Yeah, that would be nice, and we've got a chance to start fixing that come 2014, and powered by the Free the Elected campaign that we're running, we're going to be highlighting the whole concept of it and making sure that everybody knows where each one of these people stands on getting corporate money out of politics. So we're absolutely after that. But on the subject of, and since we just opened your mic, on the subject of equal opportunity of education, is that, and I got somebody who's listening in the background, and if you could just mute your, because there's a little bit of a delay there. Thank you. How do you feel about equal opportunity in education, and how can we, if it's a good thing, how do we get it done, Neil?
Of course, I think everybody should have equal opportunity in education. I think you have to make it more affordable, give people an opportunity, and to make sure that they're not in this massive amount of debt once they get out, that they're, for the rest of their life, they're paying it off.
Okay, that's great. I think we're talking more in the public school systems in the K through 12s.
You need better quality teachers. You need people who are very motivated to get things done and giving everybody the same opportunity to excel. You know.
Okay, Paul. Paul.
Yes.
Paul, the fiscally conservative. Are our schools
yes.
broken? Do we need to fix them? And if so, how?
The public school system is actually a big peeve of mine. I would, and it's actually kind of hard to say where to even start. One of the things that I noticed was that when I was at my son's class ceremony handing out rewards, the teacher said that almost every child in the class had almost straight A's. And that struck me as really strange, because I'm sitting there thinking, how is that every child does so well? I remember teachers saying that proper curriculum gives you somewhat of a spread, so that you have some children that are really good, some that are in the middle, and some not so. So I'm thinking that maybe the curriculum is not challenging enough. My other thing is that I remember somebody, I had to step away because my wife called that, and she was between her and you, sorry, she won. When it comes to, you know, whether or not a child makes it, if they need to repeat a grade, so be it. If they need to do summer school, so be it. We definitely do need really good teachers. I have seen really good teachers, but I've also seen I've taken a good look at my son's textbooks. And I'm really not impressed, and I know that this is going to be a bit controversial. Me controversial never. But I would really like to see the whole concept of evolution taken out of the textbooks because there's no science in it. It says we had an ice age.
Okay,
10,000
years ago. Joel, hang on. That's fine. We could talk about individual curriculum. That's fine. But we want to keep it in general to the how we fix it. And it sounded to me like you might be in favor of a self-paced curriculum where each child goes at their own pace. The smarter ones get to zoom ahead. The middle ones stay at their own pace. The slower ones, that's okay too. Would that be acceptable?
That's what children do need. That's why in high school there's AP courses and there's remedials.
Beauty. Phenomenal. Laura Simmons.
Once again, I'm the rebel. I think there's a perspective that people are that a lot of people miss. Okay, you know, there's this thing called comprehension skills, and I hate to say it, and yeah, I'm the rebel. You know, because I get something different when I read a story than what you get, doesn't mean that I don't have comprehension skills and you do. It just means
right.
I have things, I see things from a different perspective than you do. So that makes me the dumb one and you the smart one. I really resent that. I think that we all have different skills, different abilities, and I don't think it's fair to say that we should all excel in everything and all be little clones and robots of each other.
Right,
that's
beautiful. That's beautiful. So there's a couple of things
yes.
in what you're saying, and I believe are totally true. And let me get to Robert before I give you my opinion on that.
Okay.
Robert. Public school,
you know, you
how
talked
we doing?
You talked earlier about value for your dollar, for your tax dollar. One of the things that I feel about education is that one of the reasons why we're not getting value is because we don't pay teachers enough money. Now, yeah, of course there's bad teachers. There's bad everything. But there's going to be more bad teachers if you do not offer them a proper career monetary value. My great niece just became a teacher. She graduated from the University of Maryland, coincidentally, just 2 weeks ago. And she is a teacher. She that was her major. She just started, you know, did her internship, and it's interesting watching her Facebook page. Some of the comments that comes out of her mouth. Her mother is my son's godmother, and you know, the first thing I think of is, of all the places I've lived, where would be the best place for her to go teach so she can make the most money? That's you know, to have to think that way first in order to create a value for her. I know she's going to be a good teacher. I know her. You know, and there's plenty of them out there. And they're just think of all the good teachers that all of us have known. And think about how much money they're making. It is ludicrous. And so when you talk about value, of teaching, before you even go any further, the people who are teaching our children are getting dogged by society and has been for a long time, regardless of the reasons. They have been for a long time, regardless of how you fix it.
It's okay, I agree with you, Robert. How do we pay for it?
Well, you know, I mean, to our tax dollars, our property taxes. It's always been the way. Of the school system. That's how you pay for your schools in your area. The Brian was talking about that earlier. I mean, that is truly the way. I happen to live in a from my son who's going into high school, and the high school he's getting ready to go to is the bomb, and I didn't even realize it. But that's not the case in a lot of places in Georgia, because of course Georgia is one of those states where they abhor any kind of taxation discussions. So there are a lot of school districts in this state, in my area, that are horrid, you know, because they're, for all the reasons that money takes care of, infrastructure issues. You know, I'm not talking about unions. I'm not talking about any of that. I support unions. I think that they're corrupt like every other, like anything else. So,
we got five mics open. I've never done this before, so forgive me, Robert, but... So I hear you, and remember, I still pay taxes. I still pay property taxes in Georgia, and people laugh when I tell them I live in I own a 2,600 square foot home on a 30-acre wooded lot, and I pay $1,800 a year in taxes.
Exactly.
How does that compare to Maryland? How does that compare to Montgomery taxes, Brian?
You know, it's only off by a factor of three. And if you're talking about Westchester County, New York, it's off by a factor of 20.
Well, you don't even have to go out to the island. I grew up in Queens, you know, and if you're talking about New York in general, as far as you know how they pay for the school system, that's it's a whole other level. Yeah, and of course the public school system, there's a whole other level.
Can I add something?
So Paul. Who said that?
That's me, Paul.
Oh yeah. So Paul, here's what I want. Can we find the extra money to pay the teachers by cutting other spending?
Oh, I think it's plenty to cut spending. But you know, one thing I wanted to mention that it just occurred to me, going by what Robert was saying. Well, earlier the young lady mentioned that comprehension skills. I think that critical thinking definitely should be added along with comprehension skills. And when it comes to teachers. Yeah, I've taken a look at the teachers' bios. I mean, they have master degrees. They have extra classes. And a friend of mine up in Rhode Island's practically broke, he went for his master's. He just got a class. I'm thinking to myself, there's a lot of talk about teachers' pay. I have not looked at how much they get paid, but I'm thinking that a person that has all these credentials, especially if they're using these credentials to teach our children, should be getting paid well.
And they're not.
Well, what do you consider well? Hold on a second, Robert. Robert, I just want to quantify it. Paul, what do you consider paid well? Give me a number. Just throw it out there. Ballpark it.
Well, ballpark it. I'll say in relation to what I make, probably around 60 to 80, maybe. I'm really not that great with numbers, but I'll see it just to throw that out there.
Depends on where you live.
I knew you were coming. So I banged it out here. Let's see. Average teacher salary in Georgia. Starting average teacher salary in Georgia, $33,000 a year for a starter, $52,000 overall. Not enough, huh?
Yeah, I am. Unfortunately, the only field that I am familiar with the salaries of is my own field. My bad. $33,000. I made that, if I remember correctly, when I was working at McDonald's.
You're kidding.
That's
what?
No. I don't think you did.
To me, 33 is a low number.
You didn't ask him what position at McDonald's, Dan.
Sorry. He said started, so I assume he didn't start as a manager. Did you start as a manager, Paul?
No, I didn't start as a manager. I'm just kind of relating because I remember that I made $33,000, well, around there, a long time ago. And I'm right now, I'm considered to be pretty much inexperienced non-manager slash manager in my field, and right now I'm around, say, hovering around like 40-50, and I would expect a teacher with a master's degree to be able to practically blow me away.
Yeah, and that's not the case. Actually, the highest salary I've ever seen for a teacher in the public school system is in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, and it was $78,000, and there was three of them. And it's just one of those unique spots in the country. If you look around, Dan posted, George, you can do that pretty much anywhere. You know, you have teacher salaries starting in many places. I would be scared to guess what it is in Mississippi, for example. But where it's down in the 20s, you know, and that's the poverty level in this country.
I think that one of the things that should be focused on is that I think taxes absolutely need to be redirected. Spending itself needs to be cut and redirected. Our educational system is really subpar. I mean, we used to compete with the rest of the world. Nowadays, everything is coming from every other country practically. It's sad. You know, back in the early, late 70s, around there, I mean, we had an education boom. There was a demand for engineers, for heavily qualified people for various things. And I'm sitting there thinking, what happened? You know, it hasn't been easy for me to get a good paying job either, but I'm not teaching children. And if you want to have a country succeed, the money needs to be put where it's going to be invested. And that's, I feel like I'm going kind of cliche here, but if you want to invest in the country, largely you have to invest in the children.
It's a great cliche. I can tell you this, and I want to get Brian back in here because he's our special guest. But one of the things that educators have said and people that have followed the educational field is the big paradigm shift over the last 50 years has been from a very generalized education to very specialized education. And this whole idea of chasing the specialties of where the demand is actually hurting us overall. People used to be able to graduate with degrees, even from high school, and have a lot higher knowledge level, and even get 1 or 2 years of college. And if they didn't do well in one industry, if they could go into accounting, and go into apprentice type programs. And if they didn't like that, then tomorrow they could switch and they could be an engineer, and then tomorrow they could switch and they could be a plumber. There used to be a lot more opportunity and the educational system used to value a lot more general education. And more core curricula, and in fact, and Brian, maybe you can comment on that. But I mean, it seems like specializing is almost, while it seems good in the very short term, is hurting us in the long run.
Yeah, I've preached to my son to have a backup plan, and that's basically what you're saying.
Well, and the education system has to support it. Where we've moved, I agree, we've moved from general education to specialized. I think there's some other things going on. We had an economy that was looking for that. We were looking for people with generalized skills that could work in factories or in service industries, that could work in a variety of different types of tasks, because, you know, there was a supervisory and a management structure that supported it. But now a lot of work is really done independently, or really the machines are doing the work, and you have to learn to use a lot of different types of software, and that is very specialized. And so so basically you have the public education system teaching people how to read and write, and the community colleges or the companies themselves have to do the training. Well, over the past, I'd say the 10, 15 years, companies have stopped investing in a number of different things, and employee development is one of them. That's a very general statement, but it's largely true. And so you see community colleges are picking up the role that high schools used to have in doing vocational education, if it gets done at all. Or you have these these for-profit colleges coming into being to help people get degrees as technicians and things like that. And at the same time, where a lot of these jobs are drying up because they're, companies are cost-cutting or technology is taking those jobs away. So we're in transition where there's a mismatch between what the schools are producing and what the economy is looking for. In fact, what the economy is looking for is more brain work, problem solvers, critical thinking, that kind of thing. And you're not going to get that the way the general education, on grade level education system is set up, K-12. And so there are places that are doing more of that than others. But that is, I think, part of the reason you're seeing the uneven results that you have. And all kinds of other things are being blamed for it, but it's really a mismatch between where the economy is headed, which is, really, really aggressively trying to reduce labor costs, while the schools are producing labor for whom there's no jobs.
Dan, please
do, Laura.
Thank you. Paul, you misunderstood what I meant by comprehension skills. When I read a story and you read a story, what you think is the point of the story may not be what I think is the point of the story. And you can read a book one day and a year later read it and say, I don't remember reading those couple of sentences, because your mind is in a different place.
I think we're in agreement with you. I think when we talk about the concept of critical thinking, that's what we're talking about. When in Illinois, I think every high schooler in the world, we all read The Miracle Worker our freshman year, and then we learned in the Blue Book on how you took the Blue Book test, and you learned how to construct a critically thought out thesis based on the book, and it could be on any one of 100 different viewpoints, and it could be any one of 100 different opinions. That wasn't important. What was important is that you could build a logical thesis saying, here's my sentence, here's what I believe, and here's what supports that. And we could write on two totally different things, or we could write on opposite opinions. It doesn't matter. The object is, can you look through that information, and can you logically construct can you critically, through critical thought, construct an argument, if you will, out of it, or an opinion piece? And that's really all that matters.
Critical thinking is a lost art.
Dan, I took a test before I went to a community college, and it was multiple choice on comprehension skills. And basically, I couldn't believe I barely passed it, because the point that I got out of the story didn't match whatever idiot who made up the test thought was the point that I should have gotten.
And what you are arguing, Laura, is the argument against standardized testing. It has always been the argument against standardized testing, and it's one, frankly, I don't believe the standardized testing has ever been able to overcome. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, you know, it was a huge, huge movement within the minority where minority students were in the majority, I should say, in a school system, right, where they would take the same standardized tests as kids who were, say, Caucasian, and they would come up with totally different answers because what you said, their perception of those stories and the words even, because of cultural differences and the way they were brought up, were totally different. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you. Standardized testing.
Yeah, and I'm, but I happen to have been born into poverty, so I probably more match them than I do most Caucasians.
Okay. I don't think you get any argument. Anybody want to argue for standardized testing here?
Oh, okay.
I think critical thinking
to argue,
is absolutely wonderful thing. That's left art.
Okay, that was all. Thanks.
Okay. You're always welcome, Laura. You rebel, you.
I know. I always question authority. I never accept anything at face value. I like to dig.
It's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
All right, so you know what? I realize I did the pause for the cause, but I didn't do the pause for the other causes. So let me take a half a second here to get through some of the other housekeeping chores, which include, of course, talking about the other radio shows. So you're listening to Press One for Democracy. I guess I haven't had that plug in a while. This is Dan Aronson, your host. I'm here every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. on the West Coast. We run between 90 and 120 minutes of lively conversation on all kinds of fun stuff. But this is really a caller-driven show, like all the Coffee Party shows are. And so I'm really, really happy that we had this wonderful turnout tonight on the phones as well as in the chat rooms. Greg Rusick has been pounding away in the chat rooms, and I haven't probably been giving you your due, Greg, but he's been making all kinds of great points, a lot of agreements. And a lot of great points. But on my course show, of course, this is not the only Coffee Party radio show. On Tuesday nights, tomorrow night, we have The Middle Ground with Erica Beiler, left-leaning, Michael Charney, right-leaning, and they do the transpartisan dance, as it were, around all kinds of different issues and often have interesting guests. And that starts at 8 p.m. on the Eastern Standard Time. And then on Thursdays, we have a lunch with Loudon. We had Janine with us on the board. She was running the board there for a while, but had to go. Janine Loudon and Debbie LeMolino co-hosting on Lunch with Loudon. That's 3 p.m. on Eastern Standard Time. Both of them live here in the Oregon area. That's why it's Lunch with Loudon. So for those of you on the West Coast, lunching at noon, tune in to Debbie Lynn and Janine. And then on Saturdays, we have Egberto Willis, a show that Paul and and myself every once in a while, and Robert are often on a great little round table for 2 hours starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Egberto Willis. And so that is your Coffee Party lineup. Again, we are totally member-driven and member-funded, so if you're not a member of Coffee Party or you feel like we're doing a good job and you want to donate some money, go to www.coffeeparty.com, coffeepartyusa.com. And you can hit the donate button, and then there's the special project I need to plug, which is the Free the Elected campaign, where we are building a platform to which we are going to put the opinions and the political stances of every single one of our elected officials onto a database and allow you to access that, starting with campaign finance reform. What do they think about Citizens United? What do they think about the influence of money on politics, and what are their plans, if any, to get it out? So that would be
that is our Free the Elected campaign. And if you go to the Cops Party site and you donate on the Free to the Elected page, you will get an equal valued gift card from restaurants.com. So if you donate $50, you'll get a $50 gift card from restaurants.com. If you donate $100, you get $100. Well, I guess you can figure out the rest. So it's almost as if you're buying a restaurant gift card and you're on the side donating that same amount of money to the coffee party. So, again, Free the Elected, getting money out of politics, the coffee party's touchstone issue. And we are building that platform, but as everybody in technology knows, building a platform like that is not free. Can't be done with free tools. So we need to raise money. We set a goal of raising $100,000 in the next 6 months, and I think we're at about 3 or 4, so we're doing pretty well. But we need to keep that up. So joining us tonight, we have a special guest, Brian Roberts. From Montgomery County in Maryland, and we've been talking about all kinds of different issues, and we've been talking civilly and wonderfully and fact-basedly, so we really haven't touched on the issue of how do we stop the politicians and the 1% media from keeping us fighting amongst ourselves so that we kind of take our eyes off the prize, which is everything that's going on wrong in Washington, D.C. these days, from too big to jail to improper scrutiny and abuse of power, and then, of course, all of the NSA and all that good stuff. So, you know, that's the plan. The plan is to keep us fighting amongst ourselves so we kind of take our eyes off what they're doing. You know, watchdog of justice who keeps their eye on you. Well, that's us. That's our job, folks. So we got to quit fighting amongst ourselves, find our common ground. And we found a lot of it tonight. And good common solutions, and we can fix things. Brian, so we delved into education quite a bit tonight. Are there any other issues that you feel passionately about in the political arena?
Well, the issue of the economy in general, which seems to me to have narrowed to monitoring of the stock market, and the money folks have figured out how to make the stock market work without growing underlying assets, meaning, you know, making things, which are the kind of things that give people jobs, so that everybody benefits from the economic activity. So you seem to have this two-pronged problem. One, you have, quote, growth, end quote, without jobs, and what growth you do have seems to come from industries that are destroying the environment. And so these are things that keep me up at night.
So great points, all. Certainly we've turned from a manufacturing-based economy to a services-based economy, and it's difficult to grow that type of an economy because it's so computerized, and so
right.
I really don't need 100 people working on a plant is one thing, but if I can have a computer that does the brain work of 100 people, then boy, I can do that job myself. So
right.
You're right. So what do you think we can do to stimulate the economy, to put the middle class back to work, to create opportunity, not just at the top, but to get the middle class to work and kind of reinvigorate what has really been eviscerated over the last it started 30 years. It's been going on for the last 30 years, but really since the
easily.
Crash of 2008, it's taken a huge hit. So what do you think we can do?
This, of course, is tougher, but I think in one sense it's simple. You have to value the work of workers more highly. We're just dividing up the pie in a grossly unfair way. There was quite a bit of talk about, you know, what teachers get paid, and you see all of these different studies where
the folks at the top of the organization are taking a larger and larger percentage of the pie, and a multiple of the pay of the people at the top is rising, and there isn't anything going on in any of the industries that indicates that should be the case, that somehow the value of what people lower down in the organization are earning should be decreasing. But I mean, essentially, you've got across many industries stagnant or even declining wages, and not just at the bottom. There are relatively sophisticated, you know, engineering jobs. We're supposed to need all kinds of engineers to do all kinds of things, but these jobs are staying open because companies aren't doing what they used to do, which is compete for the best workers and therefore offer higher salaries. Instead of paying the salaries, they're just letting the jobs stay open. So,
well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, part of it has to be attributed to globalization. You know, we've gone ahead and we've opened up new markets.
Yeah.
And I think the intent at the beginning was to open up new markets for our products to be sold into. But in doing so, we actually opened up new markets of very cheap labor. And so now we have so much of offshoring going on of our jobs. And not just,
right.
It used to be just the really low-level manufacturing, right? We used to offshore manufacturing, you know, first to Mexico, then to the Far East, but now it's even skill jobs, skilled
it's going up
and
the chain,
decent,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So, is there something that can be done about that, or are we a victim of our own greed?
I think we're certainly a victim we are the victim of the greed of a relatively small number of people when you consider what's going on, but. I think it's time for labor unions to think globally, like corporations did quite a long time ago. They're really behind the times on that. You know, yeah, because of globalization, we have global labor markets. So we need to think about global labor unions and starting to level the playing field. It will happen eventually as workers gain more skills and there's greater competition for them. Wages in some of these low-wage areas will start to go up, but they're still much lower than they are in the West. So, you know, it's going to take too long. So we've got to organize labor around the world.
So I got to ask you through furrowed brow, do you really envision a time when the Chinese government will allow unions to organize and start pushing businesses around? You really foresee that?
You asked me what I thought should happen. I don't know what will happen. I mean, you know,
it's a great idea. I love your idea. It's just that in America, that only works because of the freedoms we have, and a lot of these other countries
don't have those
freedoms.
So China's a special case, but you wouldn't have predicted that we would have capitalism in China either 30 years ago. So I don't know where. Our economics textbooks would tell you that it's impossible to have capitalism without democracy, but that's exactly what you have in China. So, I mean, no, I'm not going to tell you that I think there's going to be a labor union tomorrow, but I'm not going to say it's out of the question. They may find that it's helpful to have a partner to help them corral a billion people, but we'll see. But there's other areas of the world, other areas in Asia that aren't run like the Chinese government, like Singapore and other places where there are educated workforces where that kind of thing might happen. So, but
look, the whole union movement, even in this country, is a shadow of its former self. You know, at this point, it's probably more likely that the union movement will disappear. But some other kind of labor organization needs to take place. Maybe it's more co-ops. Maybe it's more employee-owned companies. Gar Alperitz writes a lot about that, the University of Maryland professor. What's his dean? Is it David K. Johnson, another economist? Richard Wolf, they talk about these things, and they talk about co-ops and employee-owned ventures, and maybe that will be the way this kind of thing happens. But, you know, the current structure right now is more like a feudal serf model, and, you know, there's limited upward mobility, and so that's a problem. But more importantly, I think we've in addition to this service economy, we have a consumer driven economy, and you can't drive a consumer economy when wages are flat or declining, or you have, you know, chronic 8 to 20% unemployment or underemployment, depending on how you measure it. Can't have a consumer-driven economy. The thing will collapse. So something's got to give. But forgive me if I don't have the silver bullet answer this evening.
Oh, no. Doug, you did great. So we're winding down here. We've got about 13 minutes left in the show. What I'd like to do is this. So we've gotten to my favorite topic in the world, because to me, we could talk about our civil liberties being encroached on. We could talk about anything we want to talk about, but the bottom line is this country is hurting, and the biggest hurt right now is we just don't have enough jobs. We just do not. There's not enough work. And one thing we talked about it briefly, but one of the things that Americans are united on, at least 71%, say we need to raise the minimum wage. We need people, everybody who's working, to have a living wage. Even Mitt Romney said, let's tie it to cost of living, which was like, whoa, okay, cool. Mitt, that's not a bad idea. What I want to do is I'm going to open everybody's mic up, and, I'll start with you, Brian, since you're our special guest. And if you, again, you're king for the day, what one thing are you going to put into place that is going to create new jobs, if you have one?
If I could figure out how to do it without diluting wages, I would consider 30-hour work weeks, it would essentially force some kind of job sharing. There have been some interesting ideas about that. There's a lot of waste in the system, and I think, you know, there are people who are overpaid for what they contribute, those who are underpaid for what they contribute, and maybe if you forced a 30-hour work week, you'd force some redistribution. Whatever we have to try, it's going to be it has to be radical. We have to tip the value equation so that more people at the bottom and the middle are getting a bigger share of the pie than they're getting today, and that's one way to do it.
Beautiful. Well, listen, Brian. Again, it was an absolute pleasure. I'm glad we tripped over each other on Facebook. I hope you will come back and be a regular contributor on the show. You're obviously a very intelligent guy with all of the good coffee party traits, and just loved having you on the show, and hope you enjoyed it as much as we loved having you.
Thanks. It was fun. I'll definitely come back.
Good deal. Thanks a lot. All right. Laura Simmons, you are queen for the day. Create some jobs. Go.
Entrepreneurship, baby.
Okay. Entrepreneurship. How do we in what fields? in specific fields, or?
No, I don't think there's a specific field. I think we each need to find our own path, and, you know, even Newt Gingrich said it. Maybe we need to allow individuals who have an entrepreneurial spirit a way to have affordable loans so they can pursue that.
Okay.
And that's the price of that.
Yeah, the Small Business Association used to provide that, and then it was privatized as part of the whole trickle-down economics junk. And
it
is now a horrible, horrible program. I have a buddy of mine who is a mechanic, worked for like 15, 16 years for other people, wanted to start his own shop. And this guy spent 10 years in the Marine Corps. If ever there should have been a guy who you should have been able to get an SBA loan, it's him. He couldn't get one. So he had to start it on credit cards.
I had a friend who did the same thing, started hers on credit cards.
And
you
it's a horrible way to start.
You know, one of my favorite chapters in the Bible is the one about the body of Christ. And basically what it says is we can't all be an eye. We can't all be the fingers. We're all different, and us being all different serves a purpose.
Individualism.
Huh?
Yes, even individualism. It's part of what makes America great, and we should embrace it. I love it. Thank you, as always, Laura.
Happy party day.
All right. All right, Paul. Now, Paul, I'm going to open your mic. You're not allowed to attack Brian's idea because I know you don't like it. I want to hear Paul's idea for getting people back to work. Here you go.
Hi.
Mic's open.
First of all, Laura, thank you for using scripture well. I don't hear that happen very often. And also want to thank you, Dan, for this show. I like it. I get along with people.
come back as often as you like, but we've got about 5 minutes left, and we need to get the middle class back to work. How are we going to do it?
I think largely it comes down to the value of the dollar. We need to stop spending so it's worth more. Stop the globalization because it's more killing us than helping us. We need to manage how the money is printed as a limit. So once that happens, and at that point, that will be worth more. And instead of employees having to compete for jobs, you will have more likelihood of companies competing for qualified employees. It also comes down to education. If you can get that down and you know, people can actually have the skills. I mean, it's not something that's going to happen overnight, but it is something that really needs to happen.
All right, beautiful. Paul, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the show. Please come back and visit often. And we loved having you and your insight, and great job. Thanks very much. Now, before I open Robert's mic, I'm going to read. I haven't been ignoring you, Greg. I know you've been typing furiously, but I got Greg Rusick on the chat, and I'm going to read what he said. Greg is, he's an FDR man. I love it. Federal infrastructure programs paid for by increased taxes on the rich, closing the tax loopholes, the benefit profitable corporations, ending government subsidies to fossil fuels, reallocate a portion of the military budget. Greg, sign me up, my brother. I am for all of those things. So phenomenal job. Thanks for keeping the chat room fun. Now I'm going to open up Robert's mic. Robert, you are going to have the last word on how I'm going to try to open up Robert's mic, and he's going to give the last word on how we get the middle class back to work. You're up, sir.
If the minimum wage is raised to $9.50, that means that people will be making $18,000 a year. It is an absurd concept that the minimum wage is even going to be raised that low, if it's raised at all. Now, when it comes to getting jobs for people, if you look at today's society and what we have going on, we have lost jobs. Brian covered the labor unions to the world, which is the only way it's going to get fixed in my mind as far as wages. But we're never getting the jobs back that have gone overseas for slave wages. They're not coming back. Don't care if there's tariffs. Don't care how much you tax companies. Don't care what you do. They're still going to keep those. If you can work 100 people in the banking business at the rate of what it costs the bank to pay two people here in the United States, we're never getting those jobs back. So with that in mind, especially in the manufacturing field, which is one of our job foundations, if we're not going to be able to keep those kind of jobs in this country, then we're running out of places to get jobs. So unfortunately, this is one of the few areas that I think that our government is going to have to take the lead. And that is going to be the place that the jobs are going to have to come from. Fortunately, that doesn't leave that. That means government is going to stay bigger as opposed to smaller. But if the minimum wage gets raised to a level of livelihood in today's society and infrastructure is expanded to create new jobs, then you eliminate the safety net for a large amount of people who have to use it on the basis of what the wages are now. So that's my approach. That's one of the ways that I can find jobs. And Greg, what you mentioned to the gentleman in the chat room, a lot of the stuff that he says goes right along with that. You know, you certainly need to do infrastructure. You have to. There's no way around it. You know, if you just fix the bridges in the country on the way that they're rated, you would have so much work going on in this country right now. But of course, you got to pay for it. So there has to be something done from a tax standpoint that deals with that. Absolutely, all of that has to be done. But we're not getting the jobs back that we've lost overseas. So we have to raise minimum wage. We have to figure it out. Period. And if you create a balance where less people are on the safety net because you're raising minimum wage, it works. Because then tax money will be being used differently and more productively than it is just for the safety net, except for what the real safety net is used for. The safety net should be there for what it really needs to be.
And the extra money that those people have on top of having a living wage gets recirculated back into the economy, which grows the economy.
Exactly.
So absolutely,
exactly.
Robert, thanks very much. And I fibbed a little bit. I said you had the last word. No, I have the last word because I control the board and because it's my show. No, I'm just kidding. I just want to tell – well, here's my thing. R&D, okay? Our country's economy is driven on innovation, always has and always will, right? We need to figure out what's the next thing. And when we figure it out, if it's solar energy, we cannot let countries like China flood the market with cheap imitation products. We've got to do things better, and we've got to do things it's got to be manufacturing-based jobs, because manufacturing-type jobs, and anytime business goes into the manufacturing, when you look at manufacturing companies, you are creating jobs from top to bottom. You need your top-level CEOs and your financial guys. Let's keep them off of Wall Street and put them into business so that they can drive growth. And then let's take, we need engineers, we'll employ engineers, and then we'll employ line workers and factory workers and supervisors and facilities managers. I mean, that has got to be it. We have got to turn, and we have colleges. You know, colleges are a untapped potential of R&D. So we've got to keep innovating. We've got to keep doing what we're doing. No country in the world ever can touch the amount of innovation that's come out of this country. And the reason why it comes out of this country is because of capitalism, because there is a payoff for the innovator. So let's keep growing the economy in that matter. And on top of that, go back, fix all the infrastructure stuff. And I think between the two of them, we can create a ton of real jobs, sustainable jobs, and a huge sustainable economy. Again, I want to thank everybody who's participated, our special guest Brian from Maryland, Laura Simmons, Paul from Georgia, Robert Rodrigo, I'm almost going to start calling you a co-host, Robert. You're on so much, and I love all of your guys' input, and everybody that participated, and Greg in the chat room. This is Dan Aronson for Press One for Democracy. I will see you next Monday.